Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The images out of Syria this weekend are searing. They appear to show the deadly effects of a suspected poisonous gas attack targeting civilians, even children. President Trump tweeted, "Big price to pay." Yet days ago, Trump said he wants U.S. troops out of Syria, and he promised to send troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. Trump is also daring China on tariffs. The Wall Street Journal's Gerald Seib says Trump is wrapping up an America First approach. This hour, On Point, nationalism and the Trump White House. You can join us on air or online. How should the U.S. respond to Syria? Should the U.S. take the lead or stay on the sidelines? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Gerald Seib. He's executive Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal. You can click on his piece headlined, "Trump Plunges Ahead with America First Nationalist Approach," at our website, onpointradio.org. Hello, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. Also joining us today, Michelle Kaczynski. She's CNN's senior diplomatic correspondent, responsible for covering the State Department. She's joining us as well from Washington. Hey, Michelle.
Hello, David. Great to be here.
Glad you both are with us here to walk through some of this. Michelle, maybe start us off. Tell us a little bit about what the latest is in Syria and what the latest is in Washington in reaction to it.
Right. Well, after this, I think you run out of adjectives to describe the pictures that are coming out of this area, Douma, in East Ghouta, where this chemical attack has left scores dead, I think more than 70 now. You see pictures of children gasping for breath, foaming at the mouth, people dying on camera as you're watching. So it's very similar to the attack we saw 1 year ago, right before the United States did take limited military action in the form of airstrikes on an airfield there. So now, you know, we've seen a number of chemical attacks since that. And the one, you know, that we've been watching over the weekend, we hear some of the same words coming out of the White House. The shock from the president, I think it's very clear in his tweets that he's feeling a lot of what people around the world are feeling as we're watching these pictures. So when you see some of these tweets that the president put out, like, you know, big price to pay, and you see kind of if you can see emotion in a tweet, you usually see it with him with the use of capital letters, you can tell that he's fired up about this and that
sure.
Something is likely to there's likely to be some action. So today we're going to see UN Security Council meetings. There's a principals meeting at the White House that's about to happen. And I feel like in talking to diplomatic sources who have had conversations with the White House over the last several days, they feel pretty certain that the U.S. will do something similar and probably step it up from what we saw about a year ago.
Briefly, Michelle, what does big price to pay really mean? I mean, is this sort of a one-off little bombing raid, or is this something more consequential?
That's the real question. And when you – I think it's easy to say, oh, right, well, you know, last time the U.S. dropped 59 Tomahawk missiles, it's time to do something similar, or it will likely be something like that. You really have to look deeper and say, well, what is going to be the goal here? And that's exactly what the president and his closest advisors are going to be talking about today. I mean, they've already started discussing this, sure. They may have already an idea of what they'd like to do. But they have to consider, you know, if it is something similar to a year ago, what is the outcome really going to be? It's not going to do much. And then there's been some calls for things like, well, the U.S. should destroy aircraft from the Syrian regime. But then you look at how these chemical weapons are deployed out of helicopters. They're very mobile, so they're easy to move around. Would that really do any good? So may this time the U.S. strike Syrian regime command and control operations, something a little more substantial? I think it's possible. But again, escalation is always the big risk here. It has been since the beginning. And
well, and that that I think is an important question to ask. Jerry, I want to play this clip. President Trump talked about his aspirations for what we would do in Syria just a few days ago last Tuesday. We have a clip of that here.
I want to get out. I want to bring our troops back home. I want to start rebuilding our nation. We will have, as of 3 months ago, $7 trillion in the Middle East over the last 17 years. We get nothing, nothing out of it. Nothing.
Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal, how do we reconcile those words not so many days ago, less than a week, with what we've seen over the weekend from President Trump's Twitter feed and what appears to be, as Michelle's just described, a rather serious emotional intent of purpose from the president in the last couple of days?
Well, I think first you have to ask whether there's some connection between those words and what happened over the weekend. I mean, by saying explicitly, I want to get out of Syria, did the president embolden the Syrians? Did they think, well, the path is now clear to do what we want and clean up the opposition however we choose to do so and to have Russian complicity in doing that? So that's the first question. The second question is, I think that, you know, you've seen this before from President Trump. You've seen it from other presidents, including President Obama, including Presidents Clinton and Bush before him. There's kind of a visceral presidential reaction to these kinds of events. And your nice, cold, calculating view of the world changes because of the reality that's kind of thrust upon you at a time like this. And that's, I think, what happened to President Trump over the weekend. It happened a year ago, exactly a year ago, when there was another chemical attack and he responded with those Tomahawk missile strikes. But that was very limited. I think the irony of this attack is that by doing this, the Syrians may have ensured that the U.S. keeps its troops in Syria rather than speeds their departure. That, I think, is a likely outcome, regardless of what the president does in the short term. It's going to be kind of hard now to say, well, we're leaving and we're going to turn Syria over to the people who just gassed their own citizens. That's a tough thing. Optically, it's going to be a tough thing to sell internationally and maybe even domestically.
Obviously, we take your calls over this hour and over our programming. I'd like to turn now to Nick. He's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Sam, calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Sam, go ahead.
Hi, Dave. Dave, this is my comment here. You know, I've never understood why is it that we are the cops of the world? Why is it that we use the word retaliate when no American citizen was harmed, we were not attacked, and why is it that the region, look up on us to use the word retaliate? Is very, very strong word, because nothing happened to us, and by doing so, we expose ourselves into danger. So when we don't do, we are the bad guy. When we do, we are the bad guy.
So
never mind the fact that. In that region, there are slaughters every day.
So
nobody says that we are going to retaliate.
Sam is raising a question I think you hear. You've heard it from the president on the campaign trail. You've heard it from others. So why should America be the policeman of the world? Jerry Seib, what is our role here in trying to address this, what appears to be an atrocity in Syria, and at the same time, our responsibilities if we were to walk away? What does it look like to our allies?
Well, look, I think there are two potential answers to that question. The first one is kind of a moral answer. If you can do something, should you do something? And Syria is a place where the U.S. has been involved. The Middle East is a place where the U.S. has obviously been deeply involved. And it has leverage and it has partners. And it is a place where conceivably the U.S. could do something. The second question, I guess, is the the question of whether American interests are engaged. In other words, are you doing something simply to be a moral force in the world, or are you doing something because there also happen to be American interests engaged? And I think that a succession of American presidents, certainly since the 1960s, have decided that America's interests are engaged in the Middle East, are engaged in the question of whether that can be a stable Middle East. And therefore, this isn't just a humanitarian exercise in this particular region. This is a place where you have to look out for American national interests as well as the moral imperative.
Go ahead, Michelle, please.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, in these situations, it's hard to equate any of them, really, because something like this is so unique, as they all are. But you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. I mean, you can wait and try to stay out of it and work diplomatically. And there's always a question of whether it's going to be worse, a worse situation if there is no U.S. involvement or intervention. And worse meaning not just for the people there on the ground that we also care about, or as humans, you could say we should care about, but also for U.S. interests. That, you know, that was always a criticism of the Obama administration, that, you know, they wanted to do the right thing, but you wait too long, then it makes it worse, then more American lives are lost. It's always, to say it's a tough situation is putting it extremely simplistically. But, you know, you see things going on, like what is happening in Syria, and there are plenty of people who say the U.S. is the one who should do something about this. But if you get involved and then it turns uglier, people want out. So you kind of can't win in something that has been so entrenched as the Syrian war, but you let it go, and if you don't do anything, that question mark hangs over you.
Right. And I think the case study in that is actually in Iraq and Syria over the last, you know, 20 years, in which things drifted, chaos became the norm, Islamic State took root, and there was a giant terrorism problem that the U.S. had to face. Same thing could be said of Afghanistan in the 80s and 90s. It becomes a country the U.S. can't ignore. Al-Qaeda takes root. And that's a direct line to the 9/11 attack. So that's the way American interests get engaged in these situations.
Jerry, very briefly, you wrote a column recently in the Wall Street Journal about the president being Trump unbound, and that he was pursuing more aggressively an America First agenda than ever. In the brief amount of time we have left before the end of this segment, I want to preview what we will get into shortly. Tell us a little bit about what you meant by Trump unbound.
Well, look, I think that if you look at the arc of the Trump presidency, there were a lot of instincts that he clearly carried into the presidency that were restrained in the first year by various things. Mostly, I think, the people around him and the political circumstances around him. But now you see him saying, essentially, I am going to pursue the immigration policy that I talked about, and I don't care what the doubters think, and I'm going to pursue things like taking troops to the Mexican border. Well, that's Trump unbound.
We're discussing President Trump's America First agenda, where it will take this nation and the world. You can join the conversation. Does the president's America First agenda appeal to you? Can the U.S. command global respect and sometimes fear if it recedes from the global stage? I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, the podcast that takes you inside the Latino conversation. Each week, we'll take you into one story that will fascinate and often surprise you. Listen to Latino USA on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about President Trump forging ahead with his America First agenda. You can join the conversation. It's John Bolton's first day on the job as National Security Advisor. What do you expect? What do you want? Are you on board with the president's rhetoric on tariffs, DACA, troops at the U.S. border? And what to do, if anything, for America on Syria? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Michelle Kaczynski. She's senior diplomatic correspondent for CNN. And with Gerald Seib. He's executive Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal. I'd like to start by taking a couple of calls. First, we have Dolores calling from Waterford, PA. Dolores, go ahead.
Hi, David. How are you? I'd like to respond to the first caller's comments. The United States cannot afford to pull back from the international community. I mean, I believe we have a moral obligation to promote democracy and human rights around the globe. If we don't, you'll see more ISIS, you're going to see more Al-Qaeda, you'll see more Boko Haram, et cetera, et cetera. There needs to be somebody in place to prevent global chaos.
And you see America, Dolores, as being the place that can do that.
Yes. And we don't do it alone. I spent 20 years in the Army. I was in Bosnia. I think there were, if I remember correctly, there were 28 other countries with us and separating the three factions that were, were at each other's throats for 4 years. I mean, my personal opinion is, I mean, I don't think Trump has a grasp on the international and domestic norms. Nope. He is, if he doesn't read, how do you know what past and present foreign policy is? The presidential daily brief has been reduced to one page. I find this, and then on top of it, he plays into the hands of these authoritarian, what I call oxygen thieves, congratulating them on winning their rigged elections. I mean, to me, I find that very alarming.
Dolores, thank you so much for your call. We're now going to go to David. He's calling from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi there. Well, I think that Trump has never done what is the right thing to do. He has two main drivers. One driver is whatever suits his internal state and whatever salves his anger at the moment. And sometimes that coincides with his other driver, which is how do I solidify my base, not get impeached, and avoid getting into legal trouble? And he will do whatever to do, because that his bulwark, his 30% or whatever they are what keeps him and the Republicans whose votes are for sale in Congress from getting impeached and eventually having legal charges.
David, thanks so much for your call. David obviously views this as a sort of political imperatives driving perhaps the president's foreign policy rhetoric. Michelle, do you see a domestic politics influencing where the president's coming out on all this? His current promises to blast the Syrians somehow, his past pledges to bring the troops home?
Well, there are so many things at work here. I think he pays attention to his polls. I think he follows a path for a little while, and then he sees the poll numbers increase and increase, and there's a sense that he feels like he's on the right path, and then he keeps going in that direction. I think we're seeing a little bit of that right now. But what strikes me, too, is the emotional reaction that you see that he has to certain types of events, including this one in Syria now, where we saw it the last time, too. Some of the strongest words that he's used against Assad have come after these chemical attacks. And you wouldn't think that that was unusual, except that, the horror of Syria goes on continuously. There's an argument to be made for the fact that, the death and the pictures of people fleeing and, all of this has been happening continuously. So one chemical attack, you see them in succession. It's not really the crux of the terror that people there are dealing with. But when something like this happens, you do see President Trump react and react quickly. And I know we saw some of that, too, after Trump was affected by some of the pictures that were coming out of Yemen. And we know that he had a call with a world leader. This was a few months ago. And in that call, we know that this leader was very struck by how fired up President Trump was about this. It seems like when there is something involving children and he sees the pictures on TV and he sees that there's this growing reaction to it, mm-hmm. he then gets worked up. So you see like the anger and the emotion in his reaction, and not that that's wrong, but you know that some of that is in play here too.
There does seem to be something visceral in some of the president's reactions to things, and sometimes a bit personalized. I want to pivot a little bit to another issue that we think a lot about that involves our interactions with folks abroad and has a real impact here. I'm talking about trade. On Thursday in West Virginia, President Trump described the size of the U.S. trade deficit with China, and he says he plans to stand up to China on trade. Here's what he had to say.
For many years, no president wanted to go against China economically, and we're going to do it. We had a trade deficit of almost $500 billion last year with China, and I have great respect for the president of China, President Xi. He's a friend of mine. And I'm a friend of his, and I like him a lot. But he's representing China, and I'm representing the United States of America.
On Monday, President Trump complained about, quote, stupid trade, and I want to be clear, that's a direct quote, stupid trade with China, saying the tariffs for U.S. cars are much higher than U.S. tariffs for Chinese automobiles. He asked, does that sound like free or fair trade, talking about the relative differences in tariff sizes? His reply was, no, it sounds like stupid trade. Michelle, let's talk a bit about this for a quick moment. There's a lot of saber rattling. Is this likely to amount to much?
Probably not. I mean, there's been this debate going on over whether this is more a negotiating tactic or is this a full-on trade war. So you know you're going to see each side be tough on this. And China had threatened that it would retaliate if the U.S. did this. And we see, you know, the potential for billions of dollars. You see the potential of it hitting Midwestern farmers. I mean, plenty of people are extremely nervous about this. You know, with thoughts of what is this going to do to the U.S. economy? Why would Trump hurt his own base? So I think ultimately, and when you see the reaction of members of Congress, too, from his own party, like, whoa, wait a minute here. Wait a minute here. Even if they agree that the president has a point on some of these things, that there are, you know, there are issues with China and how their economy works and the big bubble that it's been. And how they manipulate currency. But that has changed over time. So when the president is going to see the reaction to this, which is building now, and he sees the stock market that he watches constantly and likes to tout when it's up, when he sees that fall and be as volatile as it's been, I think there's no way that he's going to be able to go through with all of this without there being major consequences for the U.S. economy and the people that he's trying to fight for.
Jerry, let's drill down on this a little bit more. Who would be likely to be hit hardest if America and then China ended up in a series of retaliations? How's that going to look?
Well, the Chinese are not foolish. They have realized that if you're going to hurt Trump in retaliation, you hurt Trump voters. And so they're particularly targeting areas of the American economy that would affect Trump states. That starts with farmers in the broad red center, politically red center of the country. And they've talked about tariffs on American imports that hurts pork farmers in Iowa, that hurts soybean farmers all around the Midwest. And they've talked about targeting some specific manufactured goods. They've talked about going after Boeing, a huge employer that has made a point of making sure it has subcontractors in all 50 states so that the pain is spread around to places that matter politically to President Trump. And I think that the question of whether that actually comes to pass or not is really an interesting, as Michelle says, an open question. It's not clear. But I think one of the problems the administration has right now, one of the problems the president has is that he kind of wants the Chinese to hear the threats of tariffs and trade wars and take it seriously, while he also wants to have his administration say to potentially affected American producers, farmers, and consumers, this is all just a negotiating tactic. Don't worry about it. I don't think these tariffs are ever going to be put into place. It's kind of hard to have it both ways. You can't have the Chinese take you seriously and Americans not take you so seriously when you're delivering the same message publicly to both. So I think there is a genuine desire and a belief within the administration that this won't devolve into a real trade war. But there's also the risk that that may be what happens anyway.
I think in some ways, Trump does have it both ways here, with maybe not the outcome that anyone expects, because he uses these threats and his own volatility is such that I think people see that, well, he even if this is going to hurt his own base, he could very well do this. So as a negotiating tactic, it works because of his own personality in an ironic way.
Well, there is an aspect of Trump which likes to keep everybody guessing.
Right.
You know that if you're unpredictable, that keeps your enemies on guard and off balance. And the same, unfortunately, is true of your friends as well. At the same time,
right.
It sounds
a little bit
like the old Kissinger line on Nixon, right? The madman theory. You just keep your opponents and your frenemies, I guess you'd think of the Chinese, guessing here. Jerry, as I mentioned earlier, you wrote this column about Trump Unbound, and you fixed his desire to withdraw troops from Syria, his desire to really talk tough on trade and other issues. You put them in sort of this more coherent narrative, saying a lot of the more conventional establishment Republicans perhaps had peeled out of the administration or been forced out of the administration. Why do you see that effect playing out that way?
Well, there was a day last week where I thought it was very striking. You had the president talking about, yes, taking troops out of Syria, bringing them home, at the same time sending troops to the Mexican border, which was a kind of a way to actually literally enact the thing he said a lot during the campaign, which is we spend more time protecting other countries' borders than protecting our own borders. Why would we do that? And then he says, I'm going to impose tariffs on $50 billion worth of Chinese imports, which was, again, an actual literal manifestation of what he said about stupid, as you said, David, trade practices during the campaign. And so all of a sudden, you had the America First nationalist candidate Trump stepping forward as President Trump 14, 15 months into his administration. And what changed? Well, I think last year there were some constraints on the president. There were constraints from Congress where he had to be in sync with congressional leaders to get, he hoped, a new health care plan passed and to get a big tax cut passed. He was restrained to some extent by people around him in the White House, people such as Gary Cohn, his chief economic advisor, and H.R. McMaster, his national security advisor. Well, Gary Cohn has left. General McMaster just left. And so I think you have either intentionally, which and I suspect it is intentionally, or by happenstance, the president kind of unshackled from some of the constraints. He doesn't need to worry about Congress and Republican leaders there so much because the agenda is about finished in Congress. Right. He's free to be the Trump who ran in 2016. And I think that is what is happening. And I think it's very much what the president intended to happen when he entered the year 2018.
We've got a call from Whitesburg, Kentucky. Sam, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, David. The policies that Trump are putting forth, I think, are a threat to the U.S. It's a physical threat, threatening our neighbors like Mexico and Canada, and also an economic threat with the tariffs. I don't see how this can possibly do anything good for the United States.
Sam, let me ask you a quick question. You said a physical threat to Mexico. What the president would undoubtedly argue is that he's sending it's not clear the details yet or how it would work, but no doubt sending troops down there to support border patrol in their effort to keep people out of this country who don't have legal status or ability to be here. So what kind of threat do you see in that?
Anytime you militarize a border, there's a threat. What happens if somebody fires a shot across the border, either side? What happens then? What are the rules of engagement? What are his plans for that, if that happens?
So, Michelle, that's a take from Sam. What message does it send to our neighbors to the south, but also to the world more generally, if we do send troops down there? Obviously, under certain kinds of restricted circumstances, Presidents George W. Bush and President Obama did, in a sense, do that without, my understanding, is tremendous success. But what message does that send?
It sends a strong message that the military needs to be involved here. And I think Sam is right that this is dangerous, but I think it's dangerous in the sense of this relationship. If you remember, at the beginning of Trump's presidency, his Secretary of State, who was then Rex Tillerson, now since fired, was in Mexico on his first big trip down there after Trump had been tweeting and talking about the wall, which really got Mexico's back up on this. You know, the relationship was bad to the point that the president of Mexico actually canceled a trip that he was going to take to visit President Trump here in the United States. So Tillerson goes down there and they're in this big meeting and they're about to meet with the president of Mexico and things are starting to go okay. They're really at the table talking. And then President Trump made this statement on television that the immigration issues with Mexico, it was going to be a military operation. And Mexico heard this and thought, what? You know, what is he talking about? So this meeting to kind of clean up the problems in the relationship fell to pieces. Tillerson had his head in his hands when he heard about what mm-hmm. Trump had said. And it was just, what? They had to break this apart. They had to regroup. The president of Mexico was not going to do this meeting down there. So they then had to clean all of this up. It just put them back at square one again. And this has real implications for how these two countries work together on immigration, on drug trafficking, which both sides want to stop.
Sure.
And work on that, as well as just NAFTA and trade and trying to be good neighbors to each other.
And take one moment here. Let's, Jerry, Sarah, you talked a little bit about DACA in your column about the Dreamers, something related, of course, to the border control. Can you briefly sketch out in the next minute for us a little bit about how you see – I mean, Trump's had more moves on this than Justin Timberlake, right?
I guess that's an interesting way of
looking at it. How would you say where he lands on this stuff?
Well, I what's the negotiating strategy? What's the bottom line? It's very hard to tell. But, you know, a month ago, it looked as if the president was not only willing but eager to have a deal in which the Dreamers, the young immigrants brought here as children without their own, you know, not in their own, with their own consent, that they would have a path to legal status and maybe even citizenship. And he wanted to get this done. In the last couple of weeks, again, in this Trump unbound period, he has reversed course and said, well, that didn't work. The Democrats didn't cooperate. There won't be any DACA deal. Too bad. Now, I don't think that's his bottom line. I think he and many Republicans don't want to be seen as the people who drive hundreds of thousands of promising young Hispanic immigrants out of the United States after we've invested as a country a lot in their education and their upbringing.
And we will see how that plays out. Jerry,
and we
Michelle,
don't know.
Exactly right. Stick with us. We're discussing President Trump's renewed push for his America First nationalist approach and what it means for the U.S. at home and abroad. You can join the conversation. Do you share President Trump's view of the world and America's place in it? Are you concerned about who will fill the void if America retreats from the world stage? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
It's Lulu Miller, and I am back with a new story for Invisibilia. It is about the pleasures.
It's just electric.
And the dangers.
There's just nothing more scary.
Of trying to live between two worlds. You can find Invisibilia on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about President Trump taking Washington into one of our guests today calls into the period of Trump Unbound. You can join the conversation. Is it time to remove the shackles and let Trump deliver on his campaign promises? Are they dangerous? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Gerald Seib, executive Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal, and with Michelle Kaczynski, senior diplomatic correspondent for CNN. We've had some response online from folks. Here's one comment from our website. Houndcat Mike writes, as much as I dislike, he calls him Demented Don, that's the president he's referring to, I do think his stance on China is good for America in the long run. China has been able to build up its military to a level that could create real trouble for the U.S. They've done it with money from having a major trade imbalance. Another listener on Twitter named Federico, he writes, Trump's policies and attitudes in many levels remind me very much of Berlusconi's past governments in Italy. And we've seen the results and the mess he left. Americans should be paying attention to history and to learn from it. We have with us now from Baltimore, Maryland, Jennifer Mendelson. She's a journalist and creator of what she calls hashtag resistance genealogy. She traces the immigration roots of lawmakers and other public figures who are in favor of a crackdown on immigration from people without legal status and also just on immigration, often legally. Jennifer, welcome to On Point.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. Can you just sketch out a little bit for me and our listeners the inspiration for what you call resistance genealogy? What spurred you to do this and what does it mean?
Well, for the past few years, I've been very involved in the genealogy world. I spend a lot of time doing genealogy for myself and as a volunteer for other people. And as immersed as I've been in looking at naturalization records and immigration records and just sort of realizing how everyone whose story I set out to do has an immigrant past, when I started seeing politicians and pundits in the news making these grand pronouncements about the dangers of immigrants, it just sort of dawned on me one day to think, well, what's their story? And it actually all started with Steve King, the congressman from Iowa, who tweeted, you know,
he's very conservative and hawkish, right, on immigration matters.
And he tweeted last March, how can we restore our civilization with someone else's babies? And the light just sort of went off over my head, and I thought, well, who's the else here? You know, we were all someone else's babies at one point. So I just hopped on Ancestry.com, and I started working up his tree. And sure enough, his own grandmother was one of those babies. And I just thought, well, this is ridiculous. So I put it out on Twitter, and the rest is sort of history.
You know, I got to say the line about babies. We were all babies once, right? was pretty powerful, both as a citizen and as a parent. Give us just a flavor. How do you do this? I mean, I don't have an Ancestry.com account. What does it entail? What kind of records are you actually getting to see original versions of?
Well, virtually all of it is publicly available. I mean, Ellis Island, you just have to go to Ellis Island, I think it's .com, .org, and you can look at anyone who came through Ellis Island. You can just search for their name, and if you know when they came and where they came from, you can find the ship's manifest. But the interesting thing is that, depending on when the person arrived, more recent records are better than older ones. They were always required to give the name, address, and relationship of the person to whom they were coming in the United States, meaning you couldn't typically just walk in without knowing somebody here. Although, interestingly, I just did Sheriff Joe Arpaio's tree, and the very first of his family to come knew nobody in the U.S., just came. But that's an aside. Anyway, so you can learn a lot because you can trace the chains in people's families that allowed family members to bring, subsequent family members until everybody was here.
You know, there was one where you found, I guess it was Stephen Miller, who's one of the top domestic policy advisors to the president. What did he say and what did you find?
Well, Stephen Miller repeated a sort of trope that irritates me when people talk about immigration, because there's a lot of mythologizing that goes on, and people like to talk about, my ancestors did everything the right way. You know, they came legally and they spoke English immediately and they assimilated. And very often we as genealogists know that that's not true. It just doesn't hold up when you look at the historical record. And in previous years, in many years of the census, people were required to say whether or not they could speak English. And Stephen Miller last summer sort of got into it in the White House press briefing room, talking about that they were going to push, they were going to favor immigrants who could already speak English. So I just sort of worked up his tree and saw that in the 1910 census, his great-grandmother, Sarah Miller, could not speak English. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not trying to shame
anybody. And she had already been here a few years, right?
Yes, I forget how many years she had been here. It was something like
3-4 years, I think, by the time in your findings. You know, you've been able to drill down, it seems to me, on administration officials, Dan Scavino, I believe it is, who's a presidential advisor, but also pundits, including Tucker Carlson, Fox News, Tammy Longrand as well. One of the questions raised is this fair? I mean, you wouldn't hold me, I would hope, responsible if a relative had committed a felony of some sort, a violent crime. We're each responsible for our own actions. Is it fair to sort of say, you say this about a policy now on immigration, but one of your forebears benefited from a more lenient or lax laws and rules?
It's not really that. What I'm trying to do is just point out the commonality of the American dream. What irritates me is that these people, just as generations of prior Americans have done, are demonizing the current wave of immigrants and suggesting that they're fundamentally unsuited to be American, which is something that you hear in every single generation. In my own family, my American-born grandmother, her sisters did not want her to marry my immigrant grandfather because they looked down on him. They thought he was beneath them. So all I'm trying to say is that the desire to become American is universal. We are a nation of immigrants. In every generation, Americans have been forged out of people who were not born in America, and that we should extend the same opportunity continually.
All part of the fabric, I guess, of the greater tapestry here that makes up America. Thank you so much. That's Jennifer Mendelson. She's creator of Resistance Genealogy. We appreciate your joining us.
Thank you so much.
Now I wanted to talk to a little bit. I wanted to get this call from Luis. He's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Luis, go right ahead.
Hi, David. I'm a DACA recipient, and I'm very scared, like every other person in my position. I'm just going to comment on how I feel about this whole situation. Like I said, I'm afraid. I don't know right now where my life is going to end up. Currently, I am in Charleston, South Carolina, studying film at the Art Institute, but I don't know, like in a few months, a year, I don't know the time frame when one day they're going to show up at my door and ask me to leave the only place I know, my home. This is my country. I plan on joining the National Guard, but currently I can't even do that. That's pretty much all I have to say.
No, Luis, thank you for sharing your thoughts and your experiences on that. Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, you've written about Trump's nationalism. You've also written about the question of the Dreamers and the president. And as people are sort of batting around policy possibilities, you know, people's lives hang in the balance. One of the things that I noted that sort of was evoked by your column was the question of how Trump defines nationalism, how Trump defines what it is to be an American. Certain language of the president, even in the departure of his own economic advisor, Gary Cohn, recently seemed to suggest the idea that, some language coming from the administration suggested that he was working on with international finance figures. It seemed to be code for either Jewish figures, as Gary Cohn is, or for people operating at elite levels. How do you see the president defining what it is to be a nationalist and what it is to be an American, keeping in mind the kind of concerns that somebody like Luis raises?
Well, look, I think the term nationalist is kind of means a lot of different things in a lot of different contexts, both in the U.S. and abroad. I think a better way to think about Trump philosophy, and I don't think he has an ideology, I think he has kind of more a philosophy or even instincts, is America first. And what does that mean? Well, I think in the Donald Trump context, and certainly in the minds of many of the people who voted for Donald Trump, it means that we should be looking out for citizens in this country who are already here and who have had a difficult time adjusting to a new globalized world and globalized world economy, and worry less about people abroad and people who aren't here already. And if that means having a tougher trade policy, that's good. If it means cutting down on immigration, that's good too. But it's in service of putting America, and I think you could actually say Americans first. And it seems like an obvious and simple thing to say, but there are a lot of Americans who don't think that's the way the world works right now, that there's a global society, not an American society, and they want to go back to a time when there was a clear and identifiable American society. And I think that's the way to interpret what we think of as Trump nationalism.
Jerry, do you see that in the absence of any question of racial identity, any question of ethnic identity? It seems to me that there are a lot of comments, both in the president's pre-presidential days before the White House and even within the White House, thinking about Charlottesville, but not only about Charlottesville, thinking about his comments of people coming from Central America to this country, but not only that, in which a lot of the president's detractors and even skeptics look to that and say, you know, there is a way in which identity and national identity in his mind seems to be forged in part on race and ethnic identity. How do you reconcile that, or do you not accept that?
Well, look, I mean, I think by definition, the Trump view of America first is deeply entwined with immigration policy. And immigration policy is by definition takes you to a racial question. And there's no escaping that connection. Now, would Trump supporters say that race is the reason they feel that way about immigration? No, they would not. But do people look at the situation and say, well, inevitably you are going to a view of the world that is tinged with racial resentments? Yeah, that's inevitable. And I think that separating those two is difficult, maybe impossible. And I think that has in turn, because of Charlottesville and things like that, gotten wrapped up in a similar debate about the United States and the domestic situation in the U.S. So like so many things in America, there is no extracting race from the debate and from the equation. So
there's also quite a lack of diversity within this administration, too. And I think that becomes evident even in photos that you see at times.
Sure. Let's quickly take a call from Center Harbor, New Hampshire. Peggy, go right ahead.
Hi, David. On the question of nationalism and America First, I would like to refer to Madeleine Albright's new book, which is A Warning Against Fascism. America has always been the beacon of hope in the world. And if we turn away, and a lot of countries now are Spain just elected a very far-right fascist-type president. If America just turns away, what does the world, where does the world look for an example of democracy.
Peggy, thank you so much for that call. Michelle, you know, she raises an interesting question. Obviously, we learned a lot from our experience in Iraq, humbling though it was, that sometimes American involvement does not work out the way we expect. And at the same time, you know, she raises the question, Peggy does, who will speak out for certain kinds of values we think of inherently as American if America doesn't step up to do that?
Ah, right. American values. I mean, that's a phrase that's used by both sides of the political spectrum so often. But sometimes you just don't really know what it means anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to have changed over time. And I'm glad that she mentioned Albright, because I think she said some of the most striking things through this transition. She's really sounded the alarm over things like big cuts to the State Department. She's called what's been going on there an abdication of U.S. leadership. And she said that it's potentially weakening America. So you have this, you know, this core of what you think you consider American values, and then you have this balance that we're trying to come to of domestic issues versus international crises, and it's difficult. I mean, it's always been, but now there seems to be this question of, you know, do we support democracy around the world, and when, and how strongly, and when do we stand up for that? And the U.S. standing in the world. I think there have been many strong voices, not just Democratic voices, but many Republican voices over the last several months, worried about what kind of leadership the U.S. will have in various regions around the world, what kind of void a stepping back could mean, and how much, you know, strengthening that could give to Russia and Iran in some places and China.
Mm-hmm.
And when the U.S. is going to focus more on domestic issues and say, no, we're definitely not the world's policeman anymore, and we're not going to spend our money there, and this is a waste of money, and that's a waste of money, even though it hasn't been considered a waste of money over many administrations and decades, what is that going to mean for who's going to fill those voids and how that could come back and bite the U.S. later?
Cherry Saib, if you don't mind, just in the minute that we have left for you, sketch out what the best case scenario looks like from your thinking about what leadership looks like on the global scene under Trump and America First presidency, as you've described
well,
it.
Well, look, I think I think the best case scenario is that a lot of Trump rhetoric about withdrawal from the world is really just to make a point, not to be taken literally, and that the U.S. remains engaged in the world, even if it's in a different way, even if it's in a way in which it challenges its allies to do more, and it challenges China to change the trade rules, and it challenges Vladimir Putin while trying to maintain good relations with him. If that's what Trump, the Trump view of the world and the Trump engagement with the world looks like, I think that is something that both Trump supporters would like and that people who want to see the U.S. play a leadership role could accept. I think the danger lies, and Madeleine Albright points out, I think that this is not just an American danger but an international danger, because
mm-hmm.
a lot of these tendencies are all around the world for people to withdraw into their own little tribes. And that's a dangerous recipe.
That's Jerry Saib. He's executive Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Jerry, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Michelle Kaczynski was also here. She's a senior diplomatic correspondent covering the State Department for CNN. We thank you so much for being with us today, Michelle.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.